Welcome to The Value of Knowing, the podcast where we dive deep into the world of legal complexity and opportunity on the vibrant continent of Africa. Stay tuned for expert insights and a closer look at the legal landscape in Africa, where Bowmans helps its clients to manage legal complexity and unlock opportunity. That's The Value of Knowing.
I'm Chloe Lopesha, Knowledge and Learning Lawyer at Bowmans in South Africa, specializing in employment and benefits and data protection. The focus of our conversation in today's episode is around the employment impacts of business transfers. What happens to the employees of a business where the business, as opposed to the shares in a company, is sold or otherwise transfers from one entity or employer to another? Whether you're about to acquire a business in Africa, you're selling part of your business, or your company is involved in a merger, the implications for your workforce can be significant. From the transfer of employee rights to the obligations of the new and old employers, understanding the legal landscape is crucial to ensuring a smooth transition. Bowmans has recently published a guide dealing with the employment impact of business transfers, where we discuss the legal landscape in 16 African jurisdictions. Today, I'm going to be exploring with my guests from West, East, and Southern Africa some of the key legal considerations highlighted in that guide, and they'll also get the chance to delve a little bit deeper and share some real-world examples and provide actionable tips to help our clients navigate these complex situations. Joining me on the episode today, I have Helen Wilsenach, head of our employment and benefits practice based in South Africa, as well as Terry Mwango, who is the head of our litigation and disputes practice in Kenya, both of whom have a wealth of experience in employment law. We are also very privileged today to be joined by Victoria Agomuo from our alliance firm Udo Udoma and Bello Sagi, based in Nigeria. Victoria is a senior associate at UUBO and is also an employment law specialist who contributed to the Nigeria chapter of our guide. Now, when we talk about the employment impacts of business transfers, I guess the very first question should be, where is the business that is the subject of the transfer located, and where are the employees based, as this is going to dictate which governing law applies. And it might be fairly easy where the employees and the business are all in the same country to get your head around the laws of a particular jurisdiction. But often where part of the complexity comes in is that the answer may be that the business is multinational and there are employees based in a number of countries across the continent. What is clear from the contributions to our guide is that there is no one-size-fits-all approach across Africa. And while there may be similarities in the laws of some jurisdictions, each has its own particular nuances that need to be considered. Broadly speaking, though, there are two distinct approaches when it comes to the employment consequences of a business transfer, and that is whether or not there are automatic transfer provisions that apply in the jurisdiction concerned. That is, will the employees who are employed in the business transfer automatically to the new owner of the business? Helen, South Africa is a good example of a jurisdiction in which automatic transfer provisions do apply. Could you explain what happens to employees under this regime?
Employment rights and business transfer situations in South Africa are regulated by the provisions of Section 197 of our Labour Relations Act. These provisions are very broadly modelled on the EU Acquired Rights Directive, and they apply when a business is transferred as a going concern. Effectively, what happens is that the transferee, so the new employer, is automatically substituted in the place of the transferor, so the old employer, in all contracts of employment in existence immediately before the date of transfer. In essence, what this means is that all rights and obligations between the employer and the employee continue in force as if they'd been rights and obligations between the new employer and each employee. Anything done before the transfer by or in relation to the old employer, including dismissals or commissions of an unfair labour practice or an act of unfair discrimination, is considered to have been done by or in relation to the new employer. And the transfer also does not interrupt an employee's continuity of employment. So they come over to the new employer with all their accrued years of service. In effect, the new employer basically steps into the shoes of the old employer. The other key protection afforded to employees under Section 197 is a protection against dismissal of employees that the new employer simply doesn't want to take across. It's a so-called cherry picking. This is because a dismissal is characterized as an automatically unfair if the reason for the dismissal is a transfer or a reason related to a transfer contemplated in terms of Section 197. There's also no qualifying period for protection against unfair dismissal, and the remedies for an unfair dismissal include reinstatements, the primary remedy if requested by the employee, or compensation caps in the case of an automatically unfair dismissal at 2 years' remuneration. So things can go fairly wrong if you dismiss in circumstances where it is a transfer of a business and the law doesn't allow for it. And this protection doesn't preclude dismissal on the grounds of genuine operational requirements. That is, if the true reason for the dismissal kind of post the transfer is based on the economic, technological, structural, or similar needs of the new employer.
And a similar approach to what you've just described, Helen, is followed in Angola, Cameroon, Ethiopia, Gabon, Mozambique, Senegal, and Uganda, which cover some of the jurisdictions in our guide. I think it's safe to say that in these jurisdictions, it will be critical for the buyer of a business to conduct an employment due diligence so that they know what they're getting themselves into and exactly what kinds of employee liabilities they may be taking over. In your experience, how are these risks usually mitigated?
Perhaps the most obvious way of mitigating them in the context of a sale of business is by negotiating the inclusion of appropriate warranties and indemnities in the sale of business agreement. But obviously, this can only take you so far. I mean, if the seller is no longer going to be operating or is not left with very deep pockets, then that can help, but it's not necessarily a cure-all. The other possibility is you can contract out of the provisions of 197, but what that requires is written agreement, which then would need to be concluded between either the old or the new employer or both on the one hand, and then the employees or their representatives on the other. So in effect, the employees would need agree in writing to contract out of the provisions of 197. And where we see this happen in practice is with senior execs. So if the seller doesn't necessarily want to take over the entire executive team, they would normally negotiate that they would remain behind with the seller and not transfer across to the buyer.
Not all jurisdictions in Africa follow an automatic transfer approach. Thierry, the position in Kenya, for example, is quite different, isn't it?
Yes, Chloe. In Kenya, we don't have any statutory automatic transfer provisions in relation to business transfers. And the general principle in Kenya, as confirmed in various decisions handed down by our Employment and Labor Relations Court, is that employees must consent to any transfer of employment that arises out of a transfer of business. So it's not automatic, and one cannot assume that in the course of negotiating a sale of business or a transfer of business that the employees would move as well. So what does this mean? Is that in practice, during a transfer of a business or in negotiation of similar deals, there are three options available in relation to how to handle employees. The first option within the Kenyan context is to declare the employees redundant, irrespective of whether the buyer is offering alternative employment. So what does this mean? This means that the new employer would offer fresh employment, and termination and signing of new contracts of employment would occur simultaneously, and the seller would be required to comply with the redundancy provisions under the Employment Act. So option one is you declare your current employees or the buyer's employees redundant, and then the person who's taking on the new company would have to take on board the new employees. The second option is for the old employer, the new employer, and each employee who's accepting to cross over to enter into what's called a tripartite agreement. And the name is, you know, in the meaning. So it means three different parties are signing the agreement, pursuant to which the employee agrees that their employment with the old employer is terminated and that they're taking on or accepting a new contract of employment with a new employee. What this means is that the employee would agree to a mutual termination, resign, and then waive any right to claim pre-existing or accrued benefits, for example, redundancy payments, in consideration of taking on the new employment. The agreement would also need to expressly confirm that the employee agrees to the transfer of their employment. It is always critical to make sure that this is signed by the employee so that if there's ever a dispute in future, it can be confirmed that this arrangement or agreement was consented to by the employee. And one of the most important things, Chloe, to remember in a second option scenario is that the employee can never consent to any terms that are less favorable than in their previous employment. Why is that? Because under Kenyan law, it would be perceived that they have been coerced into taking on less favorable terms. And just moving along to the third option, Chloe, would be for the employee to resign in consideration of the buyer offering a fresh employment contract and recognizing the accrued entitlements from the previous employer. And so what would happen is that the employee would write to the seller and then waive the rights to receive, for example, redundancy payments from the seller in consideration of being taken on and getting recognition of accrued entitlements. And I guess the option that is chosen in a particular transaction would largely depend on the individual circumstances of the case. So there isn't a one-size-fits-all scenario in the Kenyan context, particularly in relation to whether or not the buyer is willing to take on their employees and whether they're willing to prepare to offer them certain terms of employment. I'm guessing, Chloe, that it would always be in the seller's interest to try to persuade the buyer to take on employees with recognition of accrued entitlements so that it can avoid the cost of redundancies. But also the flip side is that there would be situations where the seller doesn't want to take on any litigation risks.
Are there ever situations where a combination of these options is used?
Yes, there are. And again, Chloe, that would depend on the particular nuances of the scenario. So, for example, you could have a second option that has a tweak of the third option as well. So, for example, where an employee doesn't write to the seller to say that they've resigned and they're taking on the new benefits, but an agreement that captures both scenarios or options so that in the tripartite agreement, you have an employee consenting to taking on the new employment, the seller saying that they would recognize the accrued payments, and the buyer saying that they would recognize certain entitlements and make certain payments in relation to those. And of course, a classic example, for example, is accrued leave or time worked. And we've seen this in relation to employees who've worked for long periods of time, where they say, you know, I've worked in this company for almost 20 years and I don't want my accrued benefits to be wiped away by this transaction. So we have seen scenarios where, you know, employees will negotiate with the seller and the buyer for a situation that allows for payments or recognition to come from both sides of the divide.
Victoria, I'd like to move on to you. Would you say that the position is similar in Nigeria?
I would say it's similar to the extent that there is no automatic transfer of employment in Nigeria. This is because, contract of employment is one of a personal service. And so you cannot just transfer from one employer to another without the consent of the employee. But one major difference I should probably point out here is that in addition to obtaining the individual employee's consent for the transfer of employment, so when you're dealing with a worker under the Labor Act, an authorized labor officer must endorse the transfer on the contract of employment of such transferred employee.
Yes, that distinction between workers and non-workers is always an important one to bear in mind when we're dealing with employment in Nigeria, isn't it? For the benefit of our listeners, would you mind explaining that difference between these two categories of employees?
Certainly. Under Nigerian law, the principal legislation that governs the employment of persons in Nigeria is the Labor Act. However, the Labor Act, in its definition section, defines workers as persons who perform manual labor or clerical function and then states that the Labor Act applies to only these persons who are called workers, and that the Labor Act does not apply to other employees who exercise administrative, executive, technical, or professional functions. So as such, you know, you have a Labor Act that's limited in its scope of application. But what usually happens in practice is that though the Labor Act, you know, applies to only those persons who were called workers, how we put it is that the Labor Act prescribes the minimum standard of and conditions of all employees. So what would happen in practice is that the Labor Act will be used as a benchmark for determining minimum terms of employment of all categories of workers, for these other persons who are excluded under the Labor Act. Now, for those who are excluded under the Labor Act, which we'll call non-workers, you know, their employment contract is governed primarily by their contract of employment and then other principles of labor law as decided by the Nigerian courts.
So you said that when it comes to the transfer of employment contracts of workers, then a labor officer must endorse the transfer. Is there anything else that parties need to bear in mind when we're dealing with the transfer of employment contracts of workers?
So our position is a bit similar to the Kenya experience as seen outlined by Terry, because similar to Kenya, where the employee in Nigeria does not consent to the transfer of their employment, or the business owner does not intend employing the seller's employee, the seller of the business will need to, you know, follow redundancy process as set out in the Labor Act, that's for the workers, and then any contractual redundancy policy, which will probably be in place in the company. So what it is that the seller is required to comply with this, the Labor Act regarding a redundancy process, you know, because the employee is refusing to consent to the transfer, or the new business owner refuses to employ the seller's employees. Now, the Labor Act defines a redundancy as an involuntary and permanent loss of employment caused by an excess of manpower. And this situation where the buyer does not intend employing the seller's employees, or where the seller's employees do not consent to the transfer, it would constitute a redundancy. Now, in carrying out a redundancy, the seller is required to comply with its redundancy policy, which will usually state the procedure to carry out a redundancy, you know, if there are going to be any consultation requirements, the calculation of redundancy payments. Where an employer doesn't have a redundancy policy, the provisions of the Labor Act is instructive. What the requirements under the Labor Act says is that the employer is required to notify employees or the trade union representatives of the reason for the redundancy and the anticipated extent of the redundancy. The employer is also required to negotiate the redundancy payment for the workers and adopt the principle of last in, first out, you know, subject to other relative merit factors, including skills, ability, and reliability, you know, determining who to declare redundant. What I have explained thus far is, you know, applicable to workers. But for non-workers, the procedure is a bit similar. There's no obligation to comply with the Labor Act since it's not, the Labor Act does not extend to such non-workers. However, where the buyer of the business is taking on the employees of the sellers, where the employees who are non-workers consent to be transferred to the buyer, there is no legal requirement to get an authorized labor officer to consent to such transfer. Now, what will usually happen is that where the buyer does not intend employing these employees, the seller will implement his redundancy policy, you know, and pay off these employees based on its redundancy policies. If there is no redundancy policy, you know, you comply with the Labor Act, which is a minimum standard. I shouldn't fail to mention that whether it is a worker or a non-worker, where the employees are unionized, the first point in negotiating anything is the collective bargaining agreement, which will usually contain, you know, the terms of redundancy, and the seller is obliged to comply with the terms of the collective bargaining agreement.
I want to move on. Another important issue that buyers will need to consider is whether or not they can go about harmonizing terms and conditions, particularly employee benefits, where they may have taken on a group of transferring employees and trying to integrate them into their existing workforce. Terry and Victoria, from what you've been telling me, I guess this may be easier in your jurisdictions where employees have agreed to take up fresh employment with the buyer.
For the situation in Kenya, if the termination of existing employees is on account of redundancy or termination is by mutual consent, the terms of the employment can be changed by the new employer, as the employment by the new employer is deemed a fresh employment contract. Having said that, where employees are transferring via a tripartite agreement, the general rule and what we've seen in the Kenyan landscape is that the terms of employment of the employees with a new employer are required to be no less favorable than their terms of employment with the old employer.
Yeah, so flowing from what Terry had just said, which is similar to what we have in Nigeria, if the transfer of the employees is carried out by way of innovation, you know, where the terms of employment are typically not changed, as what the seller does is just innovate his rights, obligation, and benefits, obligations or liabilities, you know, to the seller. And any amendment of the terms of employment post-innovation will be based on the consent of the employee, given the fact that an employer cannot unilaterally change the terms of employment of its workforce without their consent. However, where the transfer is carried out by way of a termination by the seller and a re-employment by the buyer, the employment with the buyer is a new employment. So parties are at liberty to agree on the new terms under this, and an employee has the free will to accept or reject these new terms. Usually the concerns around the term of employment, where the new terms are less favorable than the old terms under the former contract. For example, you know, bonuses are ordinarily discretionary in nature. Now imagine where the employee's former terms of employment provides a yearly guaranteed bonus of a specified percentage you get, and then there's a new term now with the employment contract which does not take this bonus into consideration. So parties usually face a deadlock when they get to this stage. So even when, you know, you try to harmonize it, these are the concerns that would arise.
Helen, I want to move on to South Africa, where we have automatic transfer of employment contracts. Can you explain the leeway that the buyer has to amend terms and conditions, or whether it needs to take over employees on exactly the same terms as they enjoyed with their old employer?
So, Chloe, unless the terms are contained in a collective agreement, in which case you then just need to comply with those terms, the buyer is not required to employ the employees on exactly the same terms and conditions. What statutory position in South Africa, what it provides is similar to what Terry mentioned in Kenya in relation to transfers that occur by way of a tripartite agreement. In this situation in South Africa, what occurs is that the new employer must employ the transferred employees on terms and conditions that are on the whole not less favorable to the employees than those in which they were employed by their old employer. The law doesn't set out what on the whole not less favorably means, and there's actually surprisingly very little case law around this point. But what it does in essence do is provide a certain measure of flexibility to allow harmonization to take place post closing of the transaction. And what is applied in practice is really a swings and roundabouts approach. So to give you an example, the new employer could reduce the transferring employee's annual leave entitlements to align with entitlements provided to the existing workforce, but then it could increase employees' salaries commensurately so that on the whole they're no worse off. If what happens overall is that there's a downwards harmonization so that the transferring employees end up with less favorable terms on the whole, then what could happen is that those employees could resign. And because their resignation would have taken place as a result of repudiatory conduct on the part of the new employer on the buyer, such resignations could constitute dismissals. In practice, employees very seldom do resign, but that is certainly the risk. And so there needs to be a very careful balancing exercise when you carry out the harmonization exercise.
Let's talk now about process. Interestingly, most of the jurisdictions in Africa don't prescribe any mandatory consultation process when it comes to the transfer of employment contracts in the context of a business transfer. But many jurisdictions, it seems, have some form of information disclosure requirements. Helen, can you start by describing how the process usually unfolds in South Africa and highlight any particular requirements that parties should bear in mind?
So Section 197, as you've highlighted, it prescribes no separate information sharing or consultation process. So that means that a transfer can lawfully take place without prior notice or consultation. That's, of course, unless notice or consultation is prescribed by a collective agreement binding on the employer, or the parties seek to conclude an agreement that varies the consequences of Section 197. If that is what you're seeking, so you're effectively asking employees to contract out of the provisions of 197, then what the law provides is that you disclose relevant information to the employees or their representative effectively so that they can make an informed decision as to whether to contract out of 197. In terms of Section 197, subsection 7, what happens in practice is that, and what's required to happen, is that the old and new employer, so the seller and the buyer, must conclude an agreement on the value of the amounts that have accrued to the transferring employees as at the date of transfer, such as their accrued annual leave, severance pay to which they would have been entitled had they been retrenched by the old employer on the transfer date, and any other accrued amounts. So these are contingent amounts. That obviously doesn't mean that you are going to be retrenching any employees, but if you were, you're required to agree on what that valuation is. And the old and new employer must, in addition, specify which of the parties would be liable for the payment of these accrued amounts as and when they fall due, and in the case of apportionment, should set out the terms of that apportionment. In practice, what normally happens is that this agreement forms part of the sale of business agreement. So it's under an employee section in the sale of business agreement, and you comply with the provisions of 197 by including a separate clause. What then is required from a disclosure point of view is that the old employer must then disclose the terms of this agreement to the transferring employees. This is usually done by way of a letter to the transferring employees, which is sent by either the seller, or could be sent by the seller and the buyer jointly, together with information like the expected date of the transfer. And basically, what you're not required to do is share the sale agreement with the transferring employees. So the disclosure requirements are actually fairly limited. But if the seller, the old employer, fails to conclude this agreement, then it remains liable jointly and severally with the new employer for a period of 12 months after the transfer date for payment of any of these amounts that may become owing to the employees as a result of retrenchment or the liquidation of the employer. So particularly for the seller, it's important that these requirements are met. And in practice, Chloe, as you know, what normally happens is that there's a type of roadshow after the sale agreement is concluded. That's when the letter would be given to the transferring employees. And the seller and the buyer, they normally work together to hold information sharing sessions with the employees, kind of a form of a roadshow. Because obviously, as the buyer, you don't want to take on employees who are unsettled, who are not sure what's going to happen post-closing. But that's more of an HR than a legal issue.
Victoria, I understand that there aren't any mandatory consultation requirements in Nigeria either, unless we're dealing with a redundancy situation. Is that right?
Yes, Chloe, you're correct. Subject to the provisions of, you know, any relevant contracts of employment, any general conditions of employment set out in an employee handbook or any collective bargaining agreement with the trade unions, there's generally no legal requirement that provides for a mandatory consultation with employees in a business transfer transaction. Now, but in practice, employers would usually inform the employees of the business transfer. I think this is particularly relevant where we are dealing with workers, and then there is that requirement for a labor officer to endorse the transfer of employment on the worker's contract. Before endorsing the transfer of employment, the labor officer is required to ensure that the worker had freely consented to the transfer and that the employee's consent had not been obtained by coercion or undue influence, or, you know, as a result of misrepresentation or mistake. Where the information of the business transfer has been shared with the worker, it will be easier for the worker to confirm this portion that, you know, that they had indeed not been coerced or, you know, unduly influenced to consent to the business transfer. As I had earlier said, where the business transfer would lead to a redundancy, the Labor Act requires that the employer should inform the trade unions or workers' representative of the reason for the redundancy and then any extent of the anticipated redundancy, and then, you know, herein will lie any mandatory consultation requirement.
Terry, I guess it's quite similar in Kenya in terms of there also being this obligation to consult in redundancy situations. But can you explain the process and circumstances where the parties are seeking to avoid the redundancy route and they're trying to follow one of those other avenues that you described to effect the transfer of employment?
It's a good question you ask, because situations we've seen in the past is where clients will assume or employers will assume that because they're not going down a redundancy route, that therefore there's no obligation to consult, which means that, you know, the buyer and the seller can have their business type negotiations and discussions and then come and impose those terms on the employees and it's take it or leave it. That is actually not how to play it in Kenya. You would still have to consult with the employees. And what does that mean, Chloe? That means that the consultation is not within the framework of a redundancy. So a redundancy process in Kenya requires that once you issue a 30-day notice of intention to declare an employee or employees redundant, that you have to consult with them during that period. But what does consultancy look like within the context of option two that I had previously touched on, which was a tripartite agreement? That simply means, Chloe, that you would have to involve your employees. So that means that at some point after the heads of terms are agreed or there's certainty about the direction in which the agreement or the business transfer arrangement is going to be implemented, that you would then bring in the most critical aspect of the piece, which is, of course, your human resource, into the conversation. And what does that mean? It means whether by town hall, whether by departmental sessions, you then explain what is going on. That also helps to allay fears about, you know, people wondering, am I going to be fired? Is it a take it or leave it? An opportunity where the employees can ask questions, you know, what does this look like? What does it mean for me? Will it actually make any difference, or does it mean that I'm just going to have a different employer on paper? So it's very important, Chloe, within the Kenyan context, that when there is a tripartite agreement, which is the option that I'm talking about right now, that employees are involved in the whole process. Because remember, Chloe, it's a tripartite agreement, meaning as an employee, I can actually say no. And we have seen situations where employees have refused to come on board. So that further complicates the situation, especially if employees feel that they were not adequately informed and so cannot make an informed decision. And there have been situations where, you know, some of our clients have had to have a mixed bag. Some people have signed a tripartite agreement and some people have had to be made redundant. So in short, Chloe, to answer your question, yes, consultations in Kenya are very important, even if you're doing a tripartite agreement, because there are situations where matters have become litigious because employees say, I signed because either I was coerced or I didn't know what I was signing. And of course, that then becomes a litigation risk for the buyer. So consult, consult, inform, inform. And always good to have a paper trail where you can show we had this consultation meeting, these are the employees who are present, so that if the matter becomes litigious or there's a dispute in future, you're able to show that you had onboarded and brought along the employees along the way.
Thanks, Terry. I like that consult, consult, inform, inform. And it really sounds like from what all three of you have said that that rings true in all of these jurisdictions. And I'm really getting the importance that HR plays in this whole process. Now, we started off this episode by giving the example of a multinational business that has employees located in more than one jurisdiction on the continent. And we've discussed now some of the different legal landscapes that might be at play and how a transfer process might unfold in each of these jurisdictions. But before we close, I'd love to discuss some of the additional complexities that might arise in a multinational transfer. Do any of you have any practical examples that you could share from your experiences in recent transactions?
you know, we had conducted a due diligence exercise on the transferor entity, and we're acting for the buyer in this instance. And, you know, at the time of the transaction, the transferee had no, that's the buyer here, had no legal presence in Nigeria, and we had flagged it to the company. We had told the buyer that, you know, further to the provisions of the Companies and Allied Matters Act 2020, that every company, every foreign company, you know, having intention to carry on business in Nigeria is required to incorporate a Nigerian entity. And then the law says that until the Nigerian entity is incorporated, the foreign entity cannot carry on business, and foreign entity cannot, you know, have a place of business or, you know, an address for service of documents or processes in Nigeria for any purpose other than, you know, purposes of pre-incorporation actions. And as such, you know, we had informed the client that the law says that for whatever the company is doing, everything will be void under the law, and then there are penalties as provided under the law. So we had informed the client of this. They had a tight calendar, and they had a strict calendar to follow. And while incorporating the Nigerian entity, the transaction had actually closed. So what they did was that they then asked us, you know, what are the other options they could, you know, go on with while they were still incorporating a Nigerian entity. And so we had, you know, informed them of the other options available under Nigerian employment law, which was either, engaging these employees as independent contractors or outsourcing the employees to a human resource agency. And I think the buyer did go on with outsourcing the employees. So what they did was that they transferred the employees to a human resource agency who was to employ the employees on behalf of the buyer. And in choosing this option, we had to inform them of the risk involved in having these employees employed by the human resource agency. We also highlighted, you know, a triangular employment possibility, you know, where the human resource agency and the buyer rather are held as co-employers of the employee. And so this are, you know, some of the nuances that could happen in a business transfer transaction.
Thanks, Victoria. Yeah, that's also a big one that I think arises in many of the jurisdictions, is this issue about whether the buyer actually has a legal presence and whether the particular laws will then even apply to that buyer. Terry, Helen, would either of you like to give us an example of another area of complexity that you've recently dealt with in a multinational context?
Yes, Chloe, if I may. A situation where the person who's selling the company had worked with employees who were kind of seconded from another entity. So whereas the payroll was being affected by the seller, they were actually not legally, they didn't hold the legal relationship, meaning that the agreement or the negotiations was not three parties. It had to be four parties. Because remember, if you're saying that I'm negotiating a tripartite agreement, and this is actually a scenario that happened in the last couple of years or last 18 months, anybody who has a legal relationship has to be involved. So if you have a situation where there's a buyer and a seller and the employee, but the seller is not actually the holder of the legal relationship, then of course it follows that whoever the legal relationship owner is or the legal employer has to be involved. And an example, again, that I can give, and maybe I can draw in from Helen's experience on this, is a situation where you have a Kenyan employee or an employer that has a multinational presence, and a Kenyan is seconded to South Africa. And then the business decides that, you know, they want to move on and enter into this business transfer relationship. So I'm curious to know, Helen, in that scenario, would the South African law scenario apply, or how would it play out? And then I can share how it would look from the Kenyan perspective.
So the transfer is only triggered between the current employer and the new employer. So you would really look where the employment relationship is sitting. And if they happen to be on secondment, temporarily on secondment at the time, that wouldn't impact on when 197 was triggered. But what it may mean practically is if you needed to wind down that secondment, that secondment would need to be terminated, or there would need to be a commercial agreement between the parties so that they can conclude that secondment. But 197 is an automatic provision. So as at the date of transfer, all the employees are predominantly assigned to the business that is being sold as a going concern will transfer. And the fact that someone may be sitting in a different location wouldn't temporarily on a secondment wouldn't impact on that. I don't know if that addresses the question.
It does, Helen, and these are the kind of loopholes or situations where we've seen clients become perhaps challenged, is where you have somebody who's employed by a Kenyan entity but sitting outside the jurisdiction. And we've seen situations where, you know, a client has then applied the foreign laws as opposed to the local laws, because under Kenyan law, if the contract is governed by Kenyan law or is a Kenyan law employment contract, then Kenyan law would have to apply, meaning that, as you rightly point out, Helen, that employee would have to be repatriated back to Kenya and the termination done in accordance with Kenyan law. And without taking over your moderation, Chloe, one other thing that I wanted to mention as well is in relation to poor performance, where there's a business transfer bubbling in the background, but then somebody is on PIP. So I'm curious to know, for example, from Victoria as well, from the Nigerian perspective, whether that would have an impact on how the business transfer or the, you know, the dealing with the employment would play out, because in a Kenyan scenario, it wouldn't necessarily mean that that process can be ignored. I don't know what the Nigerian position would be, Victoria.
Thank you, Terry. As a first point, I should mention that there is no Nigerian law on an employer's obligation where an employee is underperforming and put on a performance improvement plan. So what we do in advising clients, you know, on such issues of performance is that we are guided by the International Labour Organization's conventions and recommendations on what an employer is required to do when an employee is underperforming. So what this means here now in the context of a business transfer is that the buyer has the discretion on whether to employ such an underperforming employee further to the transaction. The buyer will still be required to obtain the employee's consent to be employed by the buyer. Now, where the buyer does not intend, you know, employing this underperforming employee here, the seller would then be required to declare the, you know, the employee's position redundant in line with the seller's redundancy position.
That's interesting. And, you know, I'll be curious to hear from Chloe as we close, because under Kenyan law, if there's somebody that's on a PIP, then the assumption would be that there isn't an intention to carry them over, unless, of course, they've turned the corner and they're better. So that would also have to be a consideration for businesses when they're negotiating these kinds of arrangements, because it doesn't always mean that everybody is going to be carried forward. And so if there are people who are under PIP, then those relationships and those conversations are not necessarily the same conversations you would have in a bigger plenary. I'm happy to hear from Helen and Victoria in terms of, you know, the general position that Chloe had presented.
Perhaps if I can just come in here. So the performance issue would be less of an issue from a South African point of view, because it's irrelevant in terms of whether the employee goes across or not. What we do sometimes see here is around the harmonization piece, because it's an automatic transfer. If you've got a multinational that is very acquisitorial and does lots of transactions, what may happen is, and if it has been active in the South African space over time, what we have seen before is that you've got employees on lots of different terms and conditions of employment because of Section 197, because there hasn't been a harmonization process. And that can be problematic in terms of from an IR point of view, and it can also potentially lead to unfair discrimination claims when those kind of differences have been allowed to carry on year after year. So in South Africa, the harmonization piece, I think, is pretty important in a multinational context. And the last point is just also timing. Because employees automatically transfer as at the closing date, it's the date when the business transfers across, this practically doesn't always work for the seller or buyer. Sometimes in a multinational context, the seller doesn't actually have a payroll set up in South Africa in time with the South African employer entity. And then there needs to be a transitional services agreement that needs to be concluded, or you need to reach agreement with the employees that they will come across at a later date and sometimes an earlier date. So whilst the automatic employee provisions in South Africa give certainty from a practical and a commercial perspective, they can also give rise to some practical difficulties.
Thank you so much to the three of you, Helen, Victoria, Terry. Thank you so much for joining me today. It's been such a great opportunity to speak to you all on this very relevant and I think really important topic for employers who may find themselves on either the side of transferring employees or on the receiving end of a business transfer. Thanks so much.
If you would like to get in touch and find out more about Bowmans, please visit bowmanslaw.com.